Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, I'll talk with native Finn and San Francisco resident Raisa Punki, whose company will present the premiere performance of Salve Regina, an original work that explores the female form and spirit. You'll also hear about the centennial celebrations happening throughout the Bay Area for native son Jack London from Chuck Levine. I'll talk by phone with soprano Patricia Rissette, who receives a Distinguished Alumni Award from the Marilla Opera Program tonight. Plus, contributor Peter Robinson will be in with a tribute to jazz singer Natalie Cole, some reflections on the 2015-16 season ahead, including the new season of Downton Abbey, and reviews of several movies. Stay with us. San Francisco-based dance company Punki Co. will present the premiere performance of Salve Regina, an original work that explores the strong, the sensual, and for some, the threatening elements of the female form and spirit in a series of six different pieces performed over the course of 90 minutes with an original score by Mark Hartensteiner. It opens tomorrow at the No Space, N-O-H space, on Mariposa Street and runs through the 17th. Punki Co. was founded in 2005 by my guest Raisa Punki. Her work is a combination of energetic and intense choreography, as well as theatrical elements, which she brings from her years working in the theater, musicals, and dance, and with collaboration and with artists collaborating from other disciplines, a core feature and principle of her company. Composer Mark Hartensteiner is the key collaborator for these works, or series of works, and he provided original music for this production, which we'll hear a taste of shortly. Raisa, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you, David.
Well, let's first, if you would, explain the title of this production, Salve Regina. Where does this idea for the production originate?
It came from my own solo that I did last September at the Westway Festival. I wanted to explore femininity in and religion. And together with Mark, I wanted him to combine the religious elements into the music. And he actually came up with the name because it comes from the Catholic hymn, Salve Regina.
So is it part of your religious sense that is being brought into the work as well?
Or? Yes, yes, of course. I don't believe I could do it from outside.
So how is it reflected? What do we see, a religious element, or is it more the inspiration for the work?
It is the inspiration, and it's about the spirit of it. And how every performer, how they themselves, what they think about the spirituality, and then of course it's partly in the musical score as well, but it's faintly. I don't like to feed anything, so I like to leave things so that we give maybe hint of something, and then audience may decide.
Well, in a broader sense, you've written that the piece is a celebration of the female spirit, body, and mind through dance, focusing on the profound strength that lies within the grounded female form. Now, what is the grounded female form?
The grounded female form is a human, a female human who knows where they are, and they know their own strength or explore it. Asking the question why, which is why we are here, why I'm here. I need to keep asking questions.
So why this, as you mentioned, it was the composer Mark Hartensteiner's suggestion to link this to the Holy Virgin, Mother of Jesus. Is that the underlying, the thread that combines all of the works, the many works?
Basically, it's a base for the beginning of the show, and then from that the line of music is then transforming into something else. And we are using many references to different cultures and their spiritual music, maybe. But I have to say that you have to probably really look into it and listen carefully to hear those.
Okay. One of the questions that you also posed as you were creating this is, why is it that a female body is sometimes perceived to be a possession belonging to someone else?
I've been very tired of listening and reading the news lately about different cultures. Yes, and about the cultures and treating of women. And even in my own home country, Finland, the issues with female women's rights and how women are treated are coming up more and more.
And what's amazing to me, I'm sure you feel the same way, is that a lot of this discussion is by men.
Yes.
And why is that? I mean,
I think it's good, on the other hand. But as a woman, this is why I want to actually do this work also, just to bring my own voice into it. And I don't know if it relates to anything else, but I think if I'm strongly behind this research, it will deliver somehow, in some form.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the cast that we'll see on stage. Your dancers range in age from 8 to 47 years old and include an expectant mother in a duet with her soon-to-be-born baby. Tell me about this one.
Yes, so the 8-year-old is my daughter. And then the 11-year-old boy is my son. And why they are in this is that they have always seen my work and they've been at the rehearsals. And they saw my work last May at the International Art Festival. And after that, they just came to me and said that, "Mom, that was so amazing. We have to be in your piece next time." And so it started to evolve when this theme came up. And it's highly important fact that because as a woman, we have a capability to create life inside, which is amazing. And so one of my dancers got pregnant, and so she wanted to explore how it feels, how the body changes, and her dancer body, how it changes.
And to celebrate that, I'm sure.
Yes,
on stage.
Absolutely. It is wonderful.
And the rest of your cast?
And the rest of the cast is Sarah Keeney and Jennifer Meek, who have been dancing with me a long time now. Amazing female dancers, very grounded, very, very powerful women. And then one male dancer, or performer actually, he's Darius Sohei, who is the newest member of the cast. This is the first time I'm working with him.
You also mentioned something about the female voice, and are you speaking to that literally? Are these ladies going to break out into song, or more metaphorically in terms of the way the female spirit speaks to us?
I think it's more metaphorically, and the voice, it's more of that. I don't know what to say more of this.
Okay. Talk to me a little bit about the costumes that are being designed.
Oh, costumes have been really important. And I love my collaborators. I choose them very carefully, and I owe a lot to them. And this time I'm working with a British costume designer, Alice Malia. And the costume idea is that I wanted to cover the faces. Part of the female faces are covered, and so I wanted to technically explore how it is to where the focus is going when the face is gone,
mm-hmm.
and how we if we combine grotesque or different kinds of movements into that covered face. So how does it read?
Sure, a challenge therefore to offer expression when the face is not
yes,
there.
Yes, yes, and it's been a really interesting journey. I actually did the solo in 1999 that I had the same kind of request. And this same costume is actually used also in this one.
We mentioned that original music is being written by Mark and Hertensteiner for this production. What is your association with Mark?
I've been working with Mark for 2 years now, and I met Mark to one of my dancers. Oh, I forgot one of my dancers, Megan Hertensteiner, who is Mark's sister. And Megan has been also dancing with for a long time. And so I met Mark through her, and we started collaborating 2 years ago. And this collaboration has been continuing, and so... And it's working wonderfully. He's amazing composer, and he's amazing person because he's taking all the CRAP that I'm giving him.
It's called artistic direction, right, in this country.
So, and I'm so perfectionist. So in this way.
So you're actually guiding him, saying this doesn't quite work. Yes. Are you guiding him as far as what instruments he's using? Is it electronica?
It's electronic, and he's actually picking up things from internet. He's using everything possible because he has a wide range of knowledge of music. He was trained classically, and he's singing at the SF Symphony Choir, and so he has a lot of knowledge of different range of music.
And you've managed to add a little bit of Finnish direction to that.
Yes. Always a little bit darkness into it.
Is he drawing on anything folk, or is it or all original works, composition? We're going to hear a bit of it shortly.
Oh, yes. So I have to say that some part he's keeping a secret from me, which I like also, so I don't know everything.
Well, then that's always nice. Are you taking this particular production elsewhere?
I hope so. And that's what I can say. Okay. I hope so.
We'll see what happens. And what is next on the Punkki Ko palette?
I'm working together with my sister, who is a filmmaker, Pauliina Punkki. And so we have a 10-year project going on that we started last summer. And then I'm doing another project to the International Art Festival 2017 with her. So I have plans for a future.
We will look out for that. And I guess we can find out more at punkkiko.com. That's punkki.co. I'm sorry. Punkkiko, punkkiko.co.com.
Yes, that's correct.
Raisa Punkki, thanks so much for taking some time today. And we'll go out with a little bit of music of Mark Hertensteiner, which will be heard through the 17th at No Space. Again, more information at punkkiko.com. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, David.
Music of Mark Hertensteiner that will be performed as part of Punkki Company's production of Salve Regina. It's at the No Space, N-O-H, No Space on Mariposa Street through the 17th. For more information, visit punkkiko.com. That's punkkiko.com. Good afternoon. I'm David Latulippe. Welcome once again to Open Air. Peter Robinson will be in with a little preview of Downton Abbey's new season, as well as some film reviews and a tribute to Natalie Cole. I'll also talk with Patricia Rosette about the honors that she's receiving tonight through the Marilla Opera Program. Well, if I were to ask you, dear listener, who was the first American writer to make $1 million, who was a world traveler, an adventurer, an innovator, social activist, whose writings were translated into 70 languages, and you replied, maybe Mark Twain? Well, I'd have to reply, you don't know Jack. But if I were to mention but one title, White Fang, you'd probably restate your reply. 100 years ago, this coming November 22nd, writer Jack London passed away at his ranch in Glen Allen, California, at the ripe old age of 40. And among the many events scheduled to commemorate him, there will be a full year of activities at the Jack London State Historical Park in Sonoma Valley. Joining me in studio to talk about the centennial celebration is Chuck Levine, someone who is not only familiar with Jack London, but was a key figure in keeping the London State Historic Park alive. Back in 2011, budget crisis, when state parks were being slated for closure, Chuck was president of the Jack London Park Partners, which stepped up as a nonprofit organization formed by concerned citizens and came to an agreement with the state, which now serves as a role model for other nonprofits as an innovative public-private partnership solution to operate the park with no money from the state. Chuck, someone who definitely knows Jack, joins me to share that success story as well as stories of the legendary Jack London. Chuck, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you, David. It's great to be here.
Well, give us a sense of just the size of the park for those that haven't ventured north and the listeners that don't know about Jack London Historic Park.
It's about 1,400 acres, almost the identical size as Jack London's ranch. It includes almost all of the property that was in Jack London's ranch. A couple of pieces were sold off, and a couple of pieces were added, but there's about that much area. That leaves us with about 35 miles of hiking trails as well as horseback and biking trails.
So this originally started as Jack London's ranch estate, and it's expanded from there, or is it primarily his property that became that was bequeathed or...
It's primarily his property. However, after his death, his wife, Charmian London, sold off a few pieces of the property to raise cash that she needed, and we received some other property sort of compensating for that. The state had excess property at the Sonoma Developmental Center, which was given to us, and that then allowed us to be back to the 1,400 acres that we started with.
And how many annual visitors are there now to the park?
This year, we're expecting about 100,000 visitors. That's up more than twice from what it was in 2011 before Jack London Park Partners took over the park.
And how did you personally get involved with this then? Was it just your proximity to the park where you're living next to it and you understood that it was then going to close unless something was done? Or were you familiar with Jack London before that?
I was familiar with Jack London only because in fourth or fifth grade, I had read Call of the Wild and White Fang. However, most of my interest came from being a neighbor. I lived next door to the park, and a group of us were involved with the park before the state had to relinquish control of it as a part of a group that was providing interpretive assistance. So we provided signage, we provided tours, and that's the organization that was the nucleus for the organization that became Jack London Park Partners and eventually ran the park.
And do you know if there are any London relatives still living?
There are. There is inside of Jack London State Park a vineyard. And the vineyard is run by the Shepherd family. And the Shepherd family are descendants of Jack London's stepsister, Eliza Shepherd.
And I imagine they get free passes to the park if they come.
Yeah. They actually have to come through the park in order to get home every day. So
okay.
they're in the park whenever they'd like to be.
Well, I'm learning so much about Jack London, as I'm sure you have over the years, and the centennial celebration is going to be a great opportunity for people to get to know him much more intimately than the author of a number of incredible novels. For instance, I didn't realize that he was one of the first implementers of sustainable farming techniques.
He was. He took ranches that had been bankrupt multiple times. He bought ranches from six different owners. Those six owners had 18 bankruptcies in the properties that he bought. He was committed to turning that around using the most modern methods combined with some of the most ancient methods. For example, when he was in Korea covering the Russo-Japanese War, he saw that the Chinese had been farming the same land for thousands of years successfully, while Americans tended to wear out their land and then move on, tended to move west and take new land. Jack London recognized that some of the techniques that were used by the Chinese, which included terracing, could help prevent the erosion that was causing the land to become worthless over time. He combined that with newer techniques. He worked with Luther Burbank, for example, in developing new plants that he thought would work well on his farm.
And I guess funding for all this came from his incredible success in his writings. I mean, the first American writer to earn over $1 million in his brief lifetime and died at 40. All the things he's done, it's pretty amazing.
And he was the highest paid author by word as well. He was making 10 to 12 cents per word, and he was committing to write at least 1,000 words before he ate in the morning. And that provided enough money to enable him to continue to expand his ranch and buy more and more properties over time.
Jack London was part of a radical literary group called The Crowd here in San Francisco and a passionate advocate of unionization, socialism, as well as the rights of workers and women. He was considered a feminist even in his own time. In addition to The Call of the Wild and The Sea Wolf, he wrote several powerful works dealing with these topics, such as his dystopian novel, The Iron Heel, as well as his expose, The People of the Abyss and The War of the Classes. It sounds like a Bernie Sanders reading list on that front and that aspect of him.
He was very interested in what I would call humanity. And so all the elements that you mentioned are a part of his concern for making the human condition better. People of the Abyss is a book about the East End of London, which was considered one of the worst slums in the world. And he traveled there, and he actually lived in the East End of London in order to gather his material to write the book. He wrote another book about life on the road in the United States when he was a vagrant. The book is called The Road, and eventually he got arrested in Erie, Pennsylvania, and had a life that was the same as the hobos that he was traveling with. He searched for gold in the Klondike. He came back with less than an ounce of gold, but he came back with a lot of material that he used in his novels. He was involved in virtually every one of the movements of the time that enabled people to better their condition.
Mm. And some of the events that are going to be happening includes a reconstruction, or how do you want to say it, a re-hike of his famous 500-mile hike.
Well, what we're doing is challenging people to hike 500 miles in the park. Jack's 500 miles were not all on his property. They were across the country. But we think that it's a challenge that a lot of people are going to want to take up. It's going to help people become healthier. It's going to help people become happier just because of the time they spend in the park. The backcountry of Jack London State Park is absolutely magnificent. It's one of the most beautiful areas you will ever see, and it's the reason that he chose the Beauty Ranch for his home.
Mm-hmm. To tell, you know, you've obviously learned more about Jack London over the years. What are some interesting things that you'd like to share about Jack London that people might not know?
Well, I think his humanitarianism is the number one thing. He certainly wrote about a number of different topics. He wrote about science fiction. He wrote the dystopian novel that you mentioned, The Iron Heel. He wrote what are called dog stories, Call of the Wild and White Fang, which if you read deeper, aren't really dog stories. They're really stories about the human condition. And so all of the things that he did were contributing to that knowledge. He only lived 40 years, so he compressed a huge amount into that lifetime. He traveled the world. He was a speaker. He spoke at places like Yale. He was an international correspondent. He covered the Jack Johnson prize fight in Australia. He covered the Russo-Japanese War. He did more in 40 years than any other 10 people that I can think of.
I know. I'm reminded of this anecdote of Tom Lehrer that says, it's people like this who make you realize how little you've accomplished.
Exactly.
In my ripe old age of 53, three days ago. So, amazing guy, amazing written works, a tremendous social advocate, an activist. Tell us, in addition to the hikes that are going on to commemorate, some of the other events that are commemorating Jack throughout the year at the park.
Throughout the year, we'll have tours. The tours include the Beauty Ranch, which is the main part of the ranch. They include the House of Happy Walls, which is our museum. They include the Wolf House, which was the dream house that Jack London built that burned to the ground just a few days before he and Charmian were scheduled to move in. We'll also have backcountry hikes, including wildflower hikes that we have during the spring. We'll have a series of adventure rides for horseback riders. For those with no experience at all, you can still go to the spot on the ranch where the most iconic photo of Jack London was taken. It's way up the mountain. It'll be pretty much an all-day ride. It should be great fun. For those more adventurous souls and people who have their own horses and are willing to travel at the same speed Jack London traveled, which was quite fast, I'll be taking out another series of adventure rides as well.
Oh, so you're actually hosting the rides?
I will be hosting the fast adventure rides.
Okay.
So if you've got horses, if you like to travel fast and your horses are in good shape, come with me. We'll also have piano concerts. We've got a book club. There's a writing contest going on right now. There will be poetry readings during the course of the year. There will also be a heritage oak seed planting at the site of a 500-year-old tree that Jack used to write under and is now on the verge of dying. But we've saved some of the acorns, we've planted them, and we've got some of its progeny that we'll
be
planting.
That's perfect. That's perfect. What other events are you personally involved with then?
I'm on the board, so all of them is the answer. I do a number of the tours and occasionally a hike. There's a lot of groups that come out. For example, there are biking groups that come out, hiking groups that come out, and I will often lead tours there. We partner with one of the local wineries, Kenwood Winery, and when they have folks that need a tour, I'm typically the person that does that. I'm also involved in planning for our gala celebration that will take place in the fall.
November 22nd is the official death anniversary of Jack London. Things happening all throughout the year at Jack London State Historical Park, and no doubt other places as well. Jack London State Historical Park and Sonoma Valley. Information about everything that's happening at the park for this centennial celebration at jacklondonpark.com. Made possible to a tremendous degree by my guest, Chuck Levine, and his nonprofit group that now runs the Jack London State Historical Park. Chuck, thanks so much for taking some time today.
Thank you.
Senza dar risposta, mi starò nascosto.
Wow, if that doesn't give you goosebumps, you ain't human. That's the voice of opera superstar Patricia Racette in her signature role of Chow Chow San in Puccini's Madama Butterfly, the 2014 Met Opera production excerpted there. Ms. Racette returns to San Francisco tonight, not to wow us, as she most recently did with her portrayal in the title role of Carlyle Floyd's Susanna, or Tobias Picker's Dolores Claiborne, or on the San Francisco Opera stage in any number of other roles, but to receive an award from the program that helped launch her career, the Marilla Opera Program, which will bestow upon her their Distinguished Alumni Award tonight across the plaza at the Veterans Memorial Building Green Room. The timing didn't quite work out to have her live in studio, but we do catch up with her by phone. Patricia Racette, welcome to Open Air, and congratulations. And we're not having Patricia Racette at the moment. Let's see here. Patricia, are you there?
All right.
There you are. Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you quite well, thank you.
Excellent. Well, congratulations on the Marilla Distinguished Alumni Award.
Thank you very much. I'm thrilled.
And that is something that really helped launch the entire Patricia Racette machine, isn't it?
It really absolutely 100% is. I give full credit, frankly. Such a fantastic program. It still is, and it really is. It's a very special training apprentice program that helped to, you know, sculpt and shape and sort of allow young artists to find their inner voices and to really get a solid start in a very practical way to this incredibly complex profession.
Well, you have made quite a career of yourself with the thanks to the launch and partially work after being a Marilla opera participant into the whole the next phase of that, the Adler Fellowships, and you've done roles, lighter roles like Rosalinda from Fledermaus, even Showboat on the San Francisco Opera stage, for which you sang Julie Verne in their production, mm-hmm. to heavies like Freya in Wagner's Ring. Where do you place yourself on your own career arc, and maybe do you find yourself leaning more towards specific roles? For instance, I understand you've officially retired the role of Chow Chow San, which we just heard.
Yes, I did. It was this past June. For me anyway, I think this happens for other opera singers as well. You hit a stop, a very, very discernible stopping point where you no longer feel that the role is for you or you for it. And I certainly had a wonderful, very prolific run with Butterfly, and you know, it'll always be very, very dear to my heart, but it was time to put that one away. You know, you mentioned other roles, lighter roles. Actually, Freya is one of the most lyric roles you can do in any of the ring. It actually is typically done by the kind of voice type as myself when was that, 1990 or something like that, I believe.
Wow.
While I was an Adler Fellow. But to answer your question, I mean, some of the roles, if you look, I've retired several roles, you know, Mimi and Michaela and Liu, and it's a matter of chapters, and you have to listen to your voice, you have to listen to your spirit, you have to listen and pay attention to your physicality and what seems appropriate. And I'm definitely in another chapter of my repertoire. I mean, I do. I just did Lady Macbeth of Mesensk.
Congratulations on this smash. Smash London reviews for that, by the way.
You're
Katarina.
It was such a rich, incredible experience. And I'm doing Zalame, and so I'm definitely doing a different kind of repertoire now, which I love and I welcome. I mean, I still do, you know, Tosca, and I'm doing Tabarro and Suor Angelica in Critico in Rome coming up in a couple months. So I still have some of my Italian repertoire mainstays, but I'm definitely delving into a different kind of repertoire that, frankly, feels incredibly appropriate for me, both vocally and temperamentally.
Terrific. When will we see you back on the San Francisco Opera stage?
Well, that's a question for David Gottlieb.
Well, or his successor.
Yes, exactly. I'm so thrilled about that appointment. I think it's such a wise choice. I've always had great respect and admiration for Matthew. So I think there are a lot of exciting things to come, and I'll look forward to my return here.
Being a part of all that, sure.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned Strauss's Salome. You'll be opening the Portland Symphony season later this month, singing the finale from Salome.
Indeed. I'll be doing that. And, you know, they're sticklers, but I have a couple other fully staged productions coming in my future, but I'm not allowed to announce. So just what it's suffice to say is that I have another couple of cracks at it, and I'm really excited. Part of what excites me so much about that role is not just the unbelievable score, is I really love the vocalism, and I love the physicality of the part. I am not one to shy away from how visceral and physical that role needs to be, and so it's just it's really, really fun. And it's, frankly, it's really fun to play someone I'm a little bit meaner. All these years of innocence.
Well, you know, when I talk with tenors or baritones, it's always more fun to sing the bad guy.
Yes, it makes for great theater. So it's a lot of fun, and it's nice to have, you know, to, as I said, to sort of balance all the, you know, at the beginning of my career with the ingenue parts, and then, you know, with the poor dying innocent victims, and so it makes for a nice, well-rounded experience as a performer, I think.
Well, we can learn more about those secret performances or the unannounced ones day by day, or, you know, just check regularly at patriciarossette.com.
Yeah, you can check at patriciarossette.com, and I rest assured we'll announce it as soon as I'm allowed, but I think you should be hearing about it in the next couple months.
Great. Well, belated thanks as well on behalf of the LGBT community. You and your partner, mezzo Beth Clayton, also recorded a video for the It Gets Better project a while back.
Yes. Yeah, well, I mean, we are married, so she's, you know, legally my wife, which I'm very, very happy to say, on that momentous day, June 26th, this last year.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. But it's, yes, we did that. It Gets Better. I'm trying to remember. I remember I was hosting Boris Godunov with the Matt HD. So whatever year that happened, that's when we made that that little snippet, which we are, you know, very pleased and, you know, humbled that it has had such a wonderful response, and a meaningful response.
Well, those HD broadcasts of the Met must be so exciting.
They're fun. In fact, I'm heading there to do the Pearl Fishers. So I head there Monday to host that one.
Well, let's have you back here in studio in person next time you're in San Francisco. I would enjoy
Absolutely.
Spending some time one-on-one with you.
That would be my pleasure.
And we are going to end with something that you can also get from the patriciarossette.com website, your recent CD, Diva on Detour. Very different from belting it out on the opera stage, I should say. Tell us about your association with the Great American Songbook.
Repeat that question?
Tell us about your interest in delving into the Great American Songbook.
Oh, I love it. I mean, it sort of expands a little bit beyond American Songbook, you know, particularly with the Piaf and all that. But I guess that's something, the whole cabaret torch song repertoire, but that's something I did before opera was ever part of my life. So for me, that's just returning home. That's sort of reconnecting with an old friend, really. And it's something that I've never totally put away. And it's, I've been able to enjoy doing particularly that show in quite a few places. I just did it in San Diego at the Balboa Theater this past November. Had a wonderful time. And I've done it, you know, in a lot of cities. And I'm due to do it, believe it or not, in Madrid, when I'm there doing street scenes in a few years. So I just absolutely love it. I'm trying to diligently work on putting together another album, and as soon as I can, you know, get that really rolling, then that'll add to that kind of repertoire and performance experience.
Well, appropriately for the Bay Area this week, we're going to end this interview with a recording of your Here's That Rainy Day from Diva on Detour. Patricia Rossette.
Yeah, I flew in on one of those yesterday. It was really
Patricia, thanks so much for taking some time today, and we look forward to seeing you in person here, and congratulations on your honors from Marilla.
Thank you so much. Lovely speaking with you.
have saved those left over dreams. Funny, but here's that rainy day. Here's that rainy day they told me about, and I laughed at the thought that it might turn out this way. Worn-out wish that I threw aside after it brought my lover near. Funny how love becomes a cold. That rainy day is here.
The great Patricia Racette from the Great American Songbook and her CD Diva on Detour. Patricia joining, among others, fellow Marilla alums Joyce DiDonato, Susan Graham, Thomas Hampson, Leona Mitchell, Deborah Voigt, among others, receiving in the past the Distinguished Alumni Award. Patricia tonight at the Veterans Memorial Building. David LaTulipe with you for Open Air, joined now by Peter Robinson, who's going to offer a season preview of Downton Abbey, a movie review or two, and a recollection of the late, great Natalie Cole. Peter, welcome to Open Air for 2016.
Yeah, happy to be here and happy new year. Even though it's the 7th, we're still just feeling our way into 2016.
Yeah, I'm not sure what quite the statute of limitations on happy. You can never not wish someone a happy new year, I guess.
There we go. It's politically correct. How about that? Yeah, and I think one of the sad losses for the end of last year, December the 31st, 2015, was the death of Natalie Cole. And just to pay a very brief tribute to her, she came, I really want to emphasize, from a total musical background. Not only her father, Nat King Cole, who was one of my favorite performers, but also her mother, Maria Cole, who actually sung with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. So on both sides of the family, you got that voice which we've all come to love and remember. And I think in that edited song duet, which she did with her father, which of course is unforgettable, I think it's also a tribute to contemporary editing, the fact that they could blend these two voices. And this was done almost a quarter century after his death.
It was very controversial, too, when it first came out.
Well, people felt you've come for one singer. I always felt you got the benefit, you got two. So I wasn't worried at all by the controversy. And for her, it was a very personal tribute to her father. And she said that when the last song came out, she felt she had finally said goodbye to him. And she let him lead with the music, and then she would come in. It's just a beautiful, beautiful song, great lyrics, and something to remember. In fact, it went on to win 6 Grammy Awards, so it got recognized both by the industry as well as by anybody who listened to it. And I think a brief word about her courage. She did have a kidney disease. She actually went on tour when she was still receiving dialysis. She was getting dialysis 3 times a week, and she was still there performing. And then eventually the agency known as Our Legacy facilitated a kidney transplant, especially for her. They nominated her as the recipient. So there's a great voice, and I know later we will hear the great song Unforgettable, but that was a sad end in one sense to 2015.
Truly unforgettable.
Now, when it comes to these New Year resolutions, I always have one response to people: in one year and out the other. And that is roughly how long they last with me.
I've already broken three myself.
You've broken three. Well, there you are. We all have to sin from time to time. For what it's worth, my three, relatively simple. I've got by the whole of my journalistic life without a smartphone, and people tell me they can't reach me. I tell them I don't like the learning curve. So here we go. This is going to be the year I actually get a smartphone, and I'm going to remember, particularly when I'm in the studio, to turn it off.
I wouldn't call that a resolution, Peter. I would say that would be getting up to the 20th century.
Moving in. Yeah. Well, when it's turned off, I always think you should get a Nobel Prize, but there we go. And so the smartphone is number one. Number two, I'm going to be out there hiking. The Marin Mountain Association runs these regular hikes, so it's time to beef up the exercise routine, and we'll see where that takes me.
Well, it could take you up to Jack London State Park for
a could.
Series of
only 500 miles, I understand. This is the length there. And then finally, we have always been involved with the literacy program with the Marin Library Association, and I still believe in that quip of Mark Twain that the man who does not read has no advantage over the man who cannot read. And so this is going to be, we're going to beef up the literacy. Now, those are some thoughts. We'll see halfway through the year whether any of them are fulfilled, but they've been on my mind today.
Remember, this is being archived. We can go back to this show and see what happened.
Well, there's nothing like a good lie. It goes a long way. So we move into the new year, and for television viewers, Downton Abbey has just embarked on its new final series. I think one of the great things about following a sequence like that is that Julian Fellowes is really a very, very good historian. And what so much of Downton Abbey is about is dealing with periods of change. So we've gone from the Edwardian twilight, we've gone through the horrors of the First World War, and now we're in 1925, the kind of semi-jazz age, but it's also the age of the telephone, the age of the radio, stuff which both upstairs and downstairs have been new and different phenomena. And I think in many ways this series, which closes, brings a sense of resolution to how you go through what in fact turned out to be quite a revolutionary period when landowners were having to cut their bills, staff have to be laid off. I won't give any secrets away. But I still quote that line from the Gilbert and Sullivan opera, and they say to a member of the House of Lords, "Tell me, sir, what do you do?" And he says, "Nothing in particular, but I do it particularly well." And I think Hugh Bonneville, as he plays the Lord, is definitely going to have to do, and not just particularly well, but also adjust. The daughters, the two remaining two daughters there, Edith and Lady Mary, they are still in pursuit of suitors. Let us see what happens there. And, of course, the butler raises the issue, should he have an assistant butler? And, of course, the answer is wait and see. But if you are an addict of this great series, I'd also suggest you flash back to an earlier one called Upstairs, Downstairs, which actually follows a very similar family routine, more based in London, but also goes through to the 1930s, which, of course, Downton Abbey will not be going through. And let me use, as a link, the role of Maggie Smith, the dowager with the smart quibs, keeps everybody in her place. In the next couple of weeks, they're going to release a new movie, which I did catch when I was in the UK. It's called Lady in the Van. And far from being a dowager, she's now a homeless person living in a van, living actually off the streets outside a real playwright. The playwright is Alan Bennett. And we know Alan Bennett from many years over. He was part of the Beyond the Fringe. And, of course, he has given us many different both stage and radio dramas. And this particular play, Lady in a Van, it did start its life in the late 90s, it's almost 10 years old, early 2000s, as a stage play. And Alan Bennett himself does appear at the very end. So it's a wonderful film in one level for the acting of Maggie Smith. On the other hand, I would not say it's a totally enthrilling story, but it's got a couple of nice, easy turns to it. So for people who like Alan Bennett, I highly recommend, when it opens in a couple of weeks' time, the movie The Lady in a Van. Now, there's a couple of movies screening at the moment, each in a strange sort of way. I've got a financial twist to them. And the first is The Big Short, which is, I think, a crime story. It's a madcap comedy at the same time. It's a heist movie, and it does try to explain in layman's terms the year 2008 and essentially what was happening for traders. It's based on the famous Michael Lewis best-selling non-fiction book. It's a very fast film to follow, and of course, I hate to say it, we all know the ending, which is not a happy ending. It's a story where there's no punishment for the crime, and people lose a great deal of money, and some make a great deal of money. I still think the best in this type of film is the Charles Ferguson 210 documentary called Inside Job, but The Big Short, I think, will give you a sense of when and how capitalism and capitalist systems can fail, and the people who suffer are the ordinary people on the tail end of mortgages that, frankly, they got almost falsely sold.
The Big Short in a number of local theaters, including the new Alamo Draft House, New Mission. So check it out. It's an interesting venue, as in many other of the major big screens and multiplexes.
And my second choice, which also forms, strangely enough, into a money movie, it's called Joy, J-O-Y. It's got some real eye candy. Jennifer Lawrence turns in a magnificent performance. And it has two parts to it. I was quite surprised how it moved from a housewife, divorced, creating a mop which actually got sold on QVC and did remarkably well. The salesman, of course, was Neil Walker, played by Bradley Cooper. The father in the movie, Rudy, is played by Robert De Niro. So you've already got a very strong cast surrounding really the central performance, which is a very good performance by Jennifer Lawrence. Now, I say it's two movies because the mop story and QVC actually led to another career. And again, no spoilers here, but the second career for this particular lady was, in my opinion, every bit as interesting as the QVC story. So those are a couple of things which are happening around the Bay Area. My two choices, Joy and also The Big Short, well worth seeing. And for television viewers, the opening of this new series, it's Series 6, it's the closing series of Downton Abbey. So if you're looking for something on either end of the historic market, whether you want the 1920s or whether you want 2008 or with Joy, well, right up to date, virtually in 2015 and 2016, these really are some films which I think will keep you informed. And then eventually, if you like Maggie Smith, don't forget when it comes out, Lady in the Van.
Peter, thank you for recommendations on the small and large screen, as well as some ideas for getting some exercise, and we'll see you again soon in the new year.
Good. Good to see you, David.
We did mention Unforgettable and Natalie Cole. Let's hear that to conclude this first edition of Open Air for 2016.
Unforgettable, that's what you are.
Unforgettable, though near or far,
like a song of love that clings to me. How the thought of you does things to me. Never before has someone been more
unforgettable. in every way.
And forevermore.
And forevermore.
That's how you'll stay.
That's how you'll stay.
That's why, darling, it's incredible that someone so unforgettable thinks that I am unforgettable too.
Unforgettable indeed. The late, great Natalie Cole and her even later, greater dad, Nat King Cole, in that performance. I'm David LaTulipe. This was the first episode of Open Air for 2016. Lots of great guests planned in the year ahead. If you've got a suggestion, please email me, david@kalw.org. And a reminder that our shows are archived at kalw.org. Thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing Open Air. See you next time.